Just a brief recall of chapter 1. Remember, chapter 1 was about the fact that Christ is the one to listen to. In the past, God spoke through prophets and various ones, and now He has spoken to us by His Son, and that His Son is greater than the angels. And we talked about and looked at a number of verses that the writer brings forth that shows that Jesus is greater than the angels in every way. And then in the beginning of chapter 2, it was kind of a little, just a little side note in a sense as far as what the writer is bringing out. But in those first four verses, he talks about because Christ is greater than the angels, we have to be very diligent not to let those things slide. It's easy to drift away. It's easy to drift away, and that's why he says you have to be so, so careful. It's like the person, and you've seen pictures or movies of, you know, they're drifting along a nice, easy river, and they don't see the great big waterfall coming up. That's what happens to Christians sometimes. They drift along, and they're drifting further and further away, and then if they keep drifting, they just fall completely. And the writer says you have to be very, very careful that that doesn't happen to you. In chapter 3, he's going to talk about how Christians can develop a heart of unbelief. They can get so far away. So he said the word that was spoken through angels was steadfast. Remember, the law of Moses was delivered through angels. A couple of places in the New Testament affirms that. And under that particular law, under that particular time, he says every transgression and disobedience received a just reward. And he said that one that came through angels, everything received the right kind of punishment, appropriate punishment. So he says, if that's true, how shall we escape? Talking about those who are living under the Christian age who have had the word delivered by God Himself, Jesus Christ, how shall we escape if we neglect what Christ has said? And of course, it's a rhetorical question saying we're not going to escape. So there is a subtle, well, really not so subtle, warning here about us in the Christian age, how it is so imperative that we watch that we don't drift away, that we don't fall away, because it's so easy. And if it was easy in the first century when this was written, it is so much easier today in our world to drift away because of all the things that's trying to pull us away from living the Christian life. And it could be a job, it could be school, it could be family, it could be neighbors. The whole culture tries to pull us away from the Christian life. So based on that, then he begins verse 5. Let me go back to the chapter here. And in particular, let's look at verse 4, or chapter, page 14 in our booklet. So the first few verses, would someone read verses 5 through 8? Most of that is a quotation. But verses 5 through 8 of chapter 2, if someone would read that.
For to the angels hath he not put in subjection the world to come, wherefore we speak. For one is a certain place that testifies, saying, what is man that thou art mindful of him? Or the Son of Man that thou visitest him? Thou madest him a little lower than the angels, but crownest him with glory and honor, and did set him over the works of thy hands.
Go ahead with verse 8, if you don't mind.
Thou hast put all things in subjection under his feet, and in that he put in subjection under him. He left nothing that is not put under him. But now we see not yet all things put under him.
Okay. First of all, this section is about Christ becoming man and why Christ had to become man and what that did for mankind. So the first thing he says, still talking again about the difference between Christ and angels, he's not put the world to come in subjection to angels. In other words, angels aren't in charge of this world. All right, they're not in charge of this world. The world is not subject to angels in any way. But, he says, going back and quoting from the Old Testament, you know, what's man that you're mindful of him? Or the son of man that you take care of him? You made him a little lower than the angels. All right? Mankind, humanity, and we talked about this last week, does not have the abilities that angels have. And we talked about some of the powers that angels have and what they're able to do and so forth. And Jesus, of course, for a time period, you know, 30-some years, he was a man. So he was made a little lower than the angels for a brief period of time. Not for eternity, but just for those few years he was on earth, he was made a little lower than the angels in the sense of he had to become man. He had to become human. And much of what the book of Hebrews talks about is about why Jesus had to become man. And what that entailed, the reasons behind it, the consequences of it. Much of the next 7 or 8 chapters in Hebrews is about various aspects of why Jesus had to become man. Why did God have to become man? Why did God have to become flesh and blood? So, because sin entered the world through Adam and Eve, then the world is not as subject to them as it could have been, as it was in the Garden of Eden. I mean, the world was completely, they were, Adam and Eve were totally in dominion over the whole world, all of that world. But when sin entered the world, part of that subjection was taken away. Part of it was taken away so that mankind, you and I, are not as, if we wanted to use the term, in charge as we could have been if sin hadn't entered the world. But sin did enter the world. And there were consequences because of that. It did a lot of things. You know, the Bible says that because of Adam and Eve's sin, it's more difficult, the world is. It's more difficult to feed the world, more difficult to feed ourselves. Work in general is far more difficult than it could have been if it hadn't been for sin. So sin brought a lot of things. The Bible says, you know, that I guess it's in Genesis 3 where man's work now is by the sweat of his face. The sweat of his face. And so, you know, difficulties came in like weeds. Can you imagine a world without weeds? I can't imagine a world without weeds. But that was the Garden of Eden, no weeds in that sense. So Adam and Eve had it made, in other words. But because of sin, that ease was taken away. And now it's much more difficult. So now we don't have that dominion over the world to the degree that Adam and Eve first had. It was taken away. And so that's what he is mentioning here when he quotes from the Old Testament. Those very things that because man sinned, then God took away many of those things. All right. Then verses 9 and 10, he says, but we see Jesus. So now he makes the, he's talked about man in general. Now he's going to talk about a particular man. But we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels. And see, that's the same phrase that he uses for mankind in general. For the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, might taste death for everyone. And this is a recurring theme in the book of Hebrews, that Jesus was made a little lower than the angels, again, for 30-some years, 33 years or whatever. But it was necessary because he had to taste death for everybody. He couldn't taste death as God because God is spirit, and spirit doesn't taste death. So for him to taste death, then he had to become human, had to have flesh. So he did taste death for everyone, for it was fitting for him. It was necessary, for whom are all things and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. So Jesus, it wasn't just the fact that he took on flesh and blood, but he had to suffer and die. Because he had to experience the same type of things you and I do. We experience pain, we experience tears, we experience suffering, we experience temptations. The only way Jesus could do that is by having a body just like ours. Even though, as he said, all things were created by him. But he still had to put on a fleshly body. And to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. And of course, that's how he became our captain, as the Hebrew writer calls him. Was it through sufferings? In other words, when he uses the word perfect there, remember, the typical translation of perfect there is complete. In other words, Jesus completed his earthly mission by suffering and dying on the cross. That's why he came. So he didn't become perfect in the sense of becoming sinless. He was always sinless. He was always morally perfect. But he had a mission. And that mission was for him to suffer and die for everyone. So in that sense, he was made perfect. But it was through sufferings. It was essential that he had to suffer. Well, then he goes on and says, for it was fitting, I mean, for both he who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified are all of one, for which reason he is not ashamed to call them brethren, saying, I will declare your name to my brethren in the midst of the assembly. I will sing praises to you. So now he begins a section that goes through the end of the chapter that talks about kind of some of the consequences of him dying. The writer has pointed out why Jesus had to become flesh, what his mission was, and why how he accomplished that mission. And now he begins to talk about some of the consequences of those things. So he who sanctifies, the word sanctifies, remember, has the idea of set apart, called out. We are the church. That's what the church basically is. The called out ones, we're called out from the world. And as a result, we are to be different than the world. Speech, actions, you know, what we do, what we don't do. We're to be different from the world. We're a holy vessel, Paul calls us in Corinthians. And as a result, we have a holy calling, and we're to be different than the world. You know, the world lives a certain way, talks a certain way, does certain things. Well, many of those Christians aren't to participate in. Why? Because we're We're holy. We're a sanctified vessel. We're a vessel set apart to be different. And if the world can't tell that we're different, then we're not living up to our calling. Something is very, very wrong. Jesus set the example for us. All right? He says, he who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified are all of one. We're all together. Therefore, he's not ashamed to call us brethren. So because of that, he's not ashamed to call us his brothers and sisters. And that, of course, is one of the marvelous things about who we are and what we're to do. He calls us the separated ones. The separated ones. We are separated. And we should feel separated in the sense of when we look out in the world and see what they do and what they're promoting and where they go, we should see that we're separated. You know, that was Israel's biggest problem for hundreds of years, was that they didn't want to be separated. They wanted to be like the nations around them. They wanted to have idols, and they wanted to have these festivals, and they wanted to do this, and they wanted to do that. And eventually they were sent off into captivity because of that. They adopted the idols and the false gods and the images, and it cost them dearly. They were kicked out of the promised land. They were sent into captivity for years. And so it was a painful lesson for them to learn. But if you've noticed, the church has done that in many ways too. If you go back, you know, even 20 years in the church, you can see how many churches of Christ have assimilated, really, the culture around them. That they never would have done in the past, but they have let the world influence them instead of them influencing the world. One of the lessons the book of Daniel teaches us. You know, Daniel had to live in a very pagan culture. But yet he wouldn't even eat some of their food, would he? You know, him and his friends were invited to the king's table and they had wine and all kinds of rich foods, and they said, no, we can't do that. We can't do that. Daniel still openly prayed throughout the day at set times. He didn't hide. So Daniel is a great lesson to us about how we are to be the separated ones. Instead of becoming like the world, we're supposed to influence the world to become like us. So that's the idea of sanctified, being holy, separated ones. Some of the other lessons from this. Well, let's go on. He says, and again I will put my trust in him, and again here am I and the children whom God hath given me. Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is, the devil, and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. There's a couple of things it tells us here that our book talks about on page 18. First of all, sin is horrible. You know, our culture doesn't even hardly know what the word sin is, really. I mean, it's just kind of tossed aside. You know, there's nothing that's really sinful other than saying that other things are sinful. If you point out that something is wrong, then you're the one that's doing the wrong. You know, you don't have any right to say something is wrong. That's what people are saying. But the Bible reaffirms that sin is the most horrible thing of all. There's nothing worse than sin and what it does. Because that's the only reason Jesus died on the cross, was because of sin. If it wasn't sin in the world, he didn't have to die. So sin is horrible. And of course, it's sin, going back to the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve, that brought death into the world. There wasn't physical death then. It wasn't spiritual death then, but sin brought both into the world. And so that's why it says here in these verses that through Jesus' death, he might destroy the devil who had the power of death and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. So Jesus, by his death, was able to render powerless what the devil could do in that sense. So now we don't have to fear death because Jesus died for us. So we don't have to fear it in that sense. Now there's hope. Jesus brought hope. And that's how he destroyed the power of Satan. He brought hope. That now we don't have to fear that death is nothingness. We know it's not. And we don't have to fear hell because Jesus gave us hope. And he did that because he, like the writer says, he took on this body and suffered and experienced pain and sorrow, and you know, he cried many times, the New Testament says, about different things, and then suffered that final last 24 hours, the worst 24 hours ever in history, the worst 24 hours that there'll ever be. And then he did all of that so that we don't have to fear death. We don't have to be in bondage to death. You know, that's how near the end of 1 Corinthians 15, that chapter on the resurrection, Paul says, you know, death, where is your sting? Well, to Christians, it doesn't have a sting. And that's what Jesus did. He took away the sting of death. And that's what the Hebrew writer says. He's released us from the sting of death. Death doesn't have victory over us. So that's what Jesus did for us. We do not have to fear, as the writer in our book says on page 19, the King of Terrors. And probably for most people, that's what death is. It's the King of Terrors. It's the thing they're afraid of the most. They might claim that they're not afraid of death, but when death comes knocking on their door, when they're about ready to leave this world, then they start fearing. Then they start changing their minds. They might make all kinds of claims, you know, in this life that, oh, I'm not afraid of death. It's just the end of consciousness and all this. But when it comes their time, when it's about over, they start rethinking that. And it is the King of Terrors. It's the King of Terrors. For indeed he does not give aid to angels. See, he goes back to angels again. But he does give aid to the seed of Abraham. And he's not talking about Jewish people. He's talking about the spiritual seed of Abraham, like the book of Galatians calls us. We are the spiritual seed of Abraham. So he doesn't give aid to angels, but us. Jesus didn't take on the nature of angels. He took on the nature of us. Jesus didn't come to save angels. He came to save us. Therefore, in all things, he had to be made like his brethren. In all ways, all things, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. Remember, propitiation has the idea of atonement, of covering sins, of taking away sins, all of that. So he had to be made like his brethren in every way. He had to have he had to feel pain, he had to be tempted, he had to feel sorrow, he had to experience death, he had to experience all of those things so that he could be a merciful and faithful high priest. He had to do all of that for us. And then he ends up, for in that he himself has suffered being tempted, he is able to aid those who are tempted. See, Jesus couldn't be a faithful high priest if he hadn't experienced what it's like to be tempted. Like the devil tempted him in Matthew 4, in the wilderness. He had to know what that was like. Otherwise, he couldn't be a faithful high priest. And so he had to go through all of that. So that's why we're to listen to Jesus and not angels. Jesus has had his glory returned and honor returned. He was only made a little lower than the angels for a short time, a few years. Well, our time is definitely up. There's probably a few more things to talk about in that section. So I would go ahead and read that, and then if you have time to read the next section for next week, into chapter 3, I would. And thank you very much for being here.